listeners and students of Hitler's Table Talk. Thanks for joining us on this August 7th, 2014, Thursday evening. I'm Carolyn Yeager.
And I'm Ray Goodwin.
So, Ray, we're on episode 22 tonight, and it's January 23rd, 1942, and Hitler is talking about everything except the war.
Correct.
But, you know, as we understand, he uses this time to relax and free his mind for a little while in order to return to war problems and strategy with a fresher perspective. And tonight he's starting out speaking about the Czechs, and we discussed last week that the new Czech government was inaugurated on January 19th and 20th, which Reinhard Heydrich played a big role in working out. It was seen as exemplary what Heydrich had accomplished as Reichsprotector of Bohemia and Moravia. Hitler and the others saw the Czechs as having been tamed for the time being. So Hitler is taking a benevolent view now, is what that's the way I see it.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Okay, well, then we're ready to start on January 23rd, I guess.
Okay, 23rd of January, 1942, midday. Special guests, Hans Lammers, who was the chief of the Reich's Chancellery, a cabinet minister without portfolio, Himmler, and Colonel Zeitzler. The man who shaped the old Reich hadn't the slightest notion of what people are like. They grew up in a climate of stupidity. They understand nothing about Austria. The fact that Austria was not a state, in the meaning we give the term, but a fruit salad of peoples, is one that escapes them. Sancta simplicitas. There was no such thing, properly speaking, as an Austrian army, but an army composed of Czech, Croats, Serb units, etc. Every Czech is a born nationalist who naturally relates everything to his own point of view. One must make no mistake about him. The more he curbs himself, the more dangerous he is. The German of the old Reich lets himself be duped by the apparent obligingness of the Czech and by his obsequiousness. Neurath let himself be completely diddled by the Czech nobility. Another 6 months of that regime and production would have fallen by 25%. Of all the Slavs, the Czech is the most dangerous because he's a worker. He has a sense of self-discipline. He's orderly. He's more a Mongol than a Slav. Beneath the top layer of a certain loyalty, he knows how to hide his plans. Now, they'll work, for they know we're pitiless and brutal. I don't despise them. I have no resentment against them. It's destiny that wishes us to be adversaries. To put it briefly, the Czechs are a foreign body in the midst of the German community. There's no room both for them and for us. One must give way.
You know, I'll just mention here that when he says, if another 6 months of von Neurath as the Reich's protector over Bohemia, Moravia, and production would have fallen by 25%, it's because there was a lot of sabotage under von Neurath by these Czech workers, and it had fallen in some places by 12% and a little bit more than that. And I get it varied, but there was a lot of that going on. And what happened when they got von Neurath didn't seem to know how to relate to the Czechs in order to make them stop that. So then when they put Heydrich in, well, then it improved greatly. I don't know if it stopped altogether, but it practically did.
That's right.
Yeah.
And one thing I wanted to add here, too, Carolyn, is when he says, to put it briefly, the Czechs are a foreign body in the midst of the German community. I mentioned this before, but that's exactly what the planners and schemers of Versailles intended when they created Czechoslovakia, a land that hadn't even existed, was to put that sort of divisiveness and a route for any external invader that wanted to invade Germany could go through Czechoslovakia. And so this was a planned thing. And with Hitler saying they are a foreign body in the midst of the German community, that's exactly what he means, and that was a result of Versailles.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. He says, as regards the Pole, it's lucky for us that he's idle, stupid, and vain. The Czech state, and that's due to the training the Czechs have had, was a model of honesty. Corruption practically didn't exist amongst them. Czech officials are generally inspired by a sense of honor. That's why a man like Haha is more dangerous than a rogue of a journalist. He's an honest man who won't enrich himself by a crown in the exercise of his functions. Men liable to corruption are less dangerous. Those are things that the Second Reich never understood. Its way of behaving towards the Poles was a deplorable setback. It only succeeded in strengthening their sense of patriotism. Our compatriots of the frontier regions who would know how to set about things with the neighboring peoples were repressed by the kindly Germans of the interior who supposed, for their part, that kindliness is the way to win these foreign hearts for Germany. At the time of Maria Theresa, everything was going well, and one can say that in the 40s, there was no question of a Polish patriotism. With the rise to power of the bourgeoisie, the conquered territory was lost again. The Tsar Ferdinand of Bulgaria said to me one day, "Do you know who's the most dangerous man? Beneš. Titulescu is venal, but Beneš, I don't believe he is." Ferdinand was really very clever. It's the duty of
You know that Beneš is actually pronounced in Czech, Beneš.
Really?
Yeah, that's the same way as some of those other names. I don't know why that is, but that's the way they pronounce it. But then most people, you know, who aren't thinking about that and still you call it Beneš. I just learned that a couple of years ago.
You know, I should have known that because down here in the area where I live, there are many, many Czech families.
Mm-hmm.
And the spelling of their last names versus the way they pronounce it is at great odds.
Yeah.
You would never guess it by looking at the lettering.
Yeah, that's right.
It's the duty of the party to settle these questions once and for all in the course of the next 500 years. The Habsburgs broke their teeth on them. They believed they could smooth everything down by kindness. The Czechs didn't have the feeling that they were being treacherous in acting as they did. In any case, it's one of the incomprehensible circumstances of history that the ancient Bavarians left those territories and the Czechs settled there. Such a situation is unbearable from the geopolitical point of view. The result has been we have the Poles close at hand, and between them and the Czechs, nothing but the narrow Silesian Strip.
Okay, well, you know, here's where I'm going to break in and talk about a news story I saw this week, and it was shortly after our last program, but it comes out of Vienna, and it says that the Czech president, Miloš Zeman, was visiting Austria, and he was being interviewed, and he repeated in this interview his previous opinion that he had given, that a post-war transfer of Sudeten Germans from then Czechoslovakia was a more moderate punishment for their high treason than the death penalty. And I thought it was kind of amazing that he's in Austria and amongst all those Germans making, but I guess they asked him about it, so he was going to stand his ground. And he praised the 10%, what he calls 10% of Sudeten Germans who stood up against Hitler's policy. Now he's talking about, World War II, and he's talking about during the war and also the post-war, kicking out the Germans mm-hmm. from Czechoslovakia. And there's still a lot of bad feeling about that amongst the Germans. There's some organizations and that say, you know, we had all this property there. You made us mm-hmm. leave behind, and we think we should have some, or at least they don't even want the money or the property, they just want an apology. They want something that make a statement that what happened to them, which they don't get. They're looked at somebody, people that didn't have any rights. But the Czech policy has been very firm about this as to not giving way in the least little mm-hmm. bit. He's saying here that the Sudeten Germans, the history is the Sudeten Germans were transferred under the decrees signed by Czechoslovak President Edward Benish, and they provided for the confiscation of the property of collaborators, traitors, ethnic Germans, and Hungarians. So if you were considered a collaborator or a traitor, or even if you were just an ethnic German and a Hungarian, according to this, your property could be confiscated, you know, legally, according to Benish's decree. The only ones they accepted were the ones who they had thought had suffered under the Nazis. It was a very anti-Nazi thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they thought they were justified. Well, there's this Sudeten German representative in Austria. As I said, there were some groups had formed. His name is Gerhard Zeisel. And he dismissed the opinion that the German minority in Czechoslovakia was guilty of occupation of Czech lands in 1939. Mm-hmm. And he came out against Zeman, dividing the Sudeten Germans into the good ones and the bad ones. And so when Zeman arrived, he, defended his statements in an interview. Mm-hmm. And he said, here's what he said then. In Austria, he says, if someone were a citizen of a country and they collaborated with the state that occupied their country, then the transfer is more moderate than, for instance, death penalty. Mm-hmm. I guess that was kind of shocking to people. And he said before the war, 90% of Sudeten Germans voted for Konrad Henlein, leader of the Nazi Party in Czechoslovakia. Well, remember, he was the leader of the party. Of a party that was pro-German, and he had a lot of people in joined and thought highly of him, and so on. It is true, but he's seen as 90% of Sudeten Germans voted for him. I don't think that's right. I think that's too high. But of course, if I were there, feeling the way I do, I would have voted for him too.
Certainly.
I would have been for him. But he says, but then he's then this Zeman. Says, I mentioned this 90% because I esteem, who voted for Hitler, he says, because I esteem very much the remaining 10%, social democrats, communists, and others who were against Hitler. Huh, I thought, man, you know, the social democrats and the communists are the ones that he's esteeming so much. But anyway, there are a lot more social democrats than 10%. I have heard from other people who lived in that area at that time. So I think he's exaggerating. But one last thing here, this Zeisel, who was representing the Sudeten Germans, reacted to the mention of Henlein, the leader of the German party at that time. And he said, if Benish had fulfilled Konrad Henlein's demand for autonomy within Czechoslovakia, that he was pushing for a long time, Hitler would have had no reason to intervene. And that's, of course, a historical record that they were mistreating the Germans, and they were doing
that's
it more
right.
and more and more. And this Henlein and was representing the ethnic Germans there and saying, you know, we object to what you're doing and standing up for them. And he was seen then as somebody who was, you know, affiliated with Hitler and disloyal to the Czech government, and therefore they get away with this whole story. But it was their fault. Everybody knows today. Everybody knows, I mean, that the Czechs were behaving stupidly against their minorities.
That's right.
And that's why that happened. But, you know, they still get up there and say what they say and get away with it a lot in a large part. So I just thought I'd bring that up.
I appreciate that because that's interesting on several levels. And one of those was, you know, of all the sadness, and there were so many things that happened that were so sad to Germany at the end of the war when everything collapsed and enemy forces closing in on all sides. But that expulsion of the Germans from Czechoslovakia was one of the saddest. And, you know, for somebody to make the statements like this article, this guy that you're referencing here,
he's the Czech president.
Yeah. If you have read honest history about that event, It was practically like a death sentence because they expelled more than 3 million people, some who had been on the land that they had for centuries, mm-hmm. and it was kind of like if you will, Bataan for those people because they were so cruelly treated, mm-hmm. and I'm talking tiny children to old folks, and the Czechs would beat them whenever they had the chance. And when he says, well, at least it wasn't a death penalty. Well, it was for many, many thousands of them.
That's
see?
Right.
And
then, you know, they had no, they had to go into Germany. There was nothing for them there.
Yes.
It was a tremendous, so more of them died. A lot of children died.
That's exactly right. Yes, yes. And that's conveniently left out.
And this guy, you just see this picture of him. He's so smug looking in this picture.
Mm-hmm.
I had to even put that in here so I could remember his smug-looking face. So, you know, I agree. And I had said, I think, last week or the week before that my impression of the Czechs was that they were an industrious people who were running their country very well. Everything was nice there. But I said that Willie Crisman said that they were sneaky. And you couldn't really trust them. And that's what is being said here, too, by Hitler.
Sure.
That they were, in that sense, they're more dangerous than any of the other groups.
Mm-hmm. So. And Hitler brings up a very important point here as we go on. He says, if I withdraw 50,000 Germans from Volhynia, that's a hard decision to take because of the sufferings it entails. The same is true of the evacuation of the southern Tyrol. If I think of shifting the Jew, our bourgeoisie becomes quite unhappy. What will happen to them? Tell me whether this same bourgeoisie bothered about what happened to our own compatriots who were obliged to emigrate.
I think that's so good. And he's spoken like that before. So that's one mm-hmm. of his things that he tells people when they say, oh, look how you're treating the Jew. Well, how much do they care when the Germans were being treated like that?
Yeah.
And not at all, you know?
Yeah.
Not at all.
That's true. And his own people, our bourgeoisie becomes mm-hmm. quite unhappy if mm-hmm. the poor Jew is mistreated, but not a word for any Germans that's caused to immigrate. So mm-hmm. very good point.
Right.
He says, one must act radically. When one pulls out a tooth, one does it with a single tug, and the pain quickly goes away. The Jew must clear out of Europe. Otherwise, no understanding will be possible between Europeans. It's the Jew who prevents everything. When I think about it, I realize that I'm extraordinarily humane. At the time of the rule of the popes, the Jews were mistreated in Rome. Until 1830, 8 Jews mounted on donkeys were led once a year through the streets of Rome. For my part, I restrict myself to telling them they must go away. If they break their pipes on the journey, I can't do anything about it. But if they refuse to go voluntarily, I see no other solution but extermination. Why should I look at a Jew through other eyes than if he were a Russian prisoner of war? In the POW camps, many are dying. It's not my fault. I didn't either want the war or the POW camps. Why did the Jew provoke this war? A good 300...
But you want to talk about that word extermination now?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a good time to take that on.
Yeah.
And I think I told you that when I read that section, that jumped at me, and I wrote in the margin, I said, uh-oh, people will take something like that and run with it, and whether there's a breakdown in translation here, something gets lost in translation, or if the word used was extermination. I find myself disagreeing with that right there, that statement, as well as when he says in the POW camps many are dying. But we'll go into that. I want you to go ahead with what you want to say.
Well, you know, that's famous that the in Himmler's speech and sometimes in Goebbels' supposed diary, controversial whether his
mm-hmm.
whether that's authentic or not, but where they use this word for getting rid of, you know. And I didn't look it up, Ray. I don't know. So I don't have all these other words here. But there's a couple of German words, and they can have quite a number of English meanings or corollaries. And they don't mean kill necessarily. They can mean to root out, to get rid of.
Displace.
Yeah, displace, and to... And which is simply goes right along with his saying, I just tell them they have to go away. He said in Rome they were humiliated them by riding on donkeys through the streets. But he says, I restrict myself to telling them they must go away. And that's really go right along with what he's meaning when he says he sees no other solution but extermination. That is, they have to go away. Mm-hmm. And, of course, to the Jewish community, whether it's actual death or not, they will see it as that, and they will make it equivalent to that and say, well, if we have to leave, well, what, you know, you're just as good as killing us, and so on. So, but it's too bad that the translators couldn't have come up with a different word, because you can mm-hmm. use different English words for that. So that's how I would see this, and I don't think he's...
Yeah, you know, I think I mentioned that word, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, that Endlosung.
Endlosung, yeah.
Yeah, that's been used.
Mm-hmm.
But this takes me back to, I was listening to Arthur Butz one time in a speech, and he said, you know, there's something about the German language that lends itself to criticism and jumping on, and he used an example, and I wish I knew the German word, but he said, take for instance the English word butterfly. He said in French it's papillon, and he said in German it's he did something, and he said what it was in German, and everybody just cracked up because it was a great example of an innocent word, except when it's said in German, oh, they would say this is hateful. And I thought that was a pretty good way that I hope.
So were you listening to Arthur Butz in person?
No, it was on a recording.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. Of a speech he had given.
How lucky of you to hear it.
Oh, yeah, I wish I would have.
Yeah.
But, yeah. Okay.
Well, that's very good.
Thank you. And it's when he says in the POW camps, many are dying, it's not my fault. I didn't want either the war or the POW camps. Why did the Jew provoke this war? That sentence jumped at me, Carolyn. I don't know if it did you, but when he says, in the POW camps, many are dying. And, you know, this is early January of 1942. And to me, I wrote in the margin here, this comment seems out of place here for January 23rd, 1942. Because the deaths in the concentration camps or prisoners of war camps became endemic much later. And so I just thought that
I thought that many of them died in 1941 when they had those million Russian POWs because they had captured so darn many right in the first weeks or week even. And they didn't have they didn't plan for that. I mean, they didn't realize they'd have all that. They didn't have the food. They didn't have anything prepared for them, and they had to put them in these big areas, and they weren't able to take care of them properly, and a lot of them did die. He might be referring to that.
You know what? That's my mistake. I think you're correct because it's right here in the POW camps. You know, he doesn't say in the concentration camps.
Right.
But that's a good point. Okay.
Yeah, and so he's aware of what's happening to the, and these are the Russians he's referring
to.
Yes,
yes.
And he's aware of what's happening, but he's saying it's not his fault. And then he says, I didn't want the war or the POW camps. Now, a lot of people would say, oh, what do you mean? You did the invasion. How can you say you didn't want the war? You're a warmonger. But, you know, he did make the first strike. But it's not that he wanted to have to go to war. I agree with that. And now here again, he's blaming it on the Jews. For provoking the war. He does that more later on, too.
Yeah, and he goes on by saying, a good 300 or 400 years will go by before the Jews set foot again in Europe. They'll return, first of all, as commercial travelers. Then gradually they'll become emboldened to settle here. the better to exploit us. In the next stage, they'll become philanthropists. They endow foundations. When a Jew does that, the thing is particularly noticed, for it's known that they are dirty dogs. As a rule, it's the most rascally of them who do that sort of thing. And then you'll hear these poor Aryan boobies telling you, you see, there are good Jews.
But hey, you know, go ahead, Ray.
No, it's all right. I was just going to continue with the reading. But
but here he shows that he didn't mean extermination
mm-hmm.
before, because he's saying that he only meant that he was going to drive them out of Europe, you know, mm-hmm. take them out of Europe.
Yeah.
And because here he says in 300 or 400 years, they'll come back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they'll regroup and they'll this and that. And if he had gotten rid of them all, they wouldn't be able to do that. And he knows that you can't really get rid of these Jews forever, but he was trying to do something that would last for mm-hmm. a long time anyway. I think that just mm-hmm. contradicts that whole interpretation.
Yeah, I think that's correct. He says, let's suppose that one day National Socialism will undergo a change and become used by a caste of privileged persons who exploit the people and cultivate money. One must hope that in that case, a new reformer will arise and clean up the stables.
Yeah, so, well, I probably should have waited until you finished.
No, that's all right. But
that's it. Yeah.
Yeah.
He says, it's like the thing. You never can do anything. It's never going to be forever. You have to keep at it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Problems come up again. And so he won't be around, but he hopes that somebody else will be, who will take care of it.
That's right. We're moving on to the 24th of January, 1942, evening.
Yeah, and I've got a timeline event. On the 24th, American troops land in Samoa as part of a strategy to stop the Japanese advance in the Pacific.
Mm-hmm. Even in peacetime, it is important when arming oneself to concentrate solely on those raw materials which one knows one will have in time of war. When the four-year plan was hatched in 1936, circumstances forced us to have recourse to substitute products. One can have no idea what it takes, even only in optical instruments, to equip an army of several million men. One day the English will realize that they've nothing to gain in Europe. 16,000 millions of debt from the First World War, to which have since been added nearly 200,000 millions. The conservatives must reckon that in order to gain a rapid success in northern Norway, for example, they would have to pay for this by abandoning India. But they're not so mad as to envisage such a solution. If they want to save New Zealand and Australia, they can't let India go. The English have two possibilities, either to give up Europe and hold on to the East, or vice versa. They can't bet on both tables. When it's a matter of the richest country in the world, from the capitalist point of view, one understands the importance of such a dilemma. It would be enough for them to be aware of it for everything to be changed. We know that the bourgeoisie becomes heroic when its pocketbook is threatened. A change of government would be associated in England with the decision to abandon Europe. They'll keep Churchill in power only so long as they still have the will to pursue the struggle here. If they were really cunning, they'd put an end to this war, thus dealing a mortal blow to Roosevelt. They would have the following excuse. We're no longer strong enough to continue the war, and you cannot help us. This leads us to reconsider our attitude toward Europe. This would result in the collapse of the American economy and also the personal collapse of Roosevelt. Simultaneously, America would have ceased to be a danger to England.
You know, it's interesting that he every so often refers to America being a danger to England. And it was, because mm-hmm. America took over England's role in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And England declined.
Mm-hmm.
But they still then depend on America, mm-hmm. since they did decline, and so they're still buddy-buddy, sort of. But but this idea, too, you know, Hitler knew that the U.S. was the problem, and he would love for the United States have stayed out of the war, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Get rid of that problem, because that was the biggest threat to him.
Absolutely. I heard, one elderly German lady years ago said that when I was asking her and her husband, because they had come to the United States after the war, and they were elderly, and this was in the late 1960s or early 70s, and I asked her a little bit about her thoughts, and she said, once the United States got in the war, we knew that we could not win it. And the thing about this quotation here where he says, we're no longer strong enough to continue the war, and you cannot help us, this leads us to reconsider our attitude toward Europe. That's the British he's referring to.
Mm-hmm.
And with what I have studied and read and talked to Tyler Kent about and read about Joseph Kennedy, the British were very, very close to that point. And that's why Churchill was so frantic in trying to get Roosevelt to jump into that war with both feet.
Yeah.
And Roosevelt says, I'm trying to, but, you don't understand. I'm hamstrung over here right now by Congress. We're trying to win them over. We will help you. Just hold on. Just hold on. And Churchill says, you don't know how desperate things are over here. And the primary thing he meant was that the British people were getting fed up with it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was unfortunate that that couldn't have gone on until they did take that.
Right.
And Hitler's analysis right there was right on the money.
Yeah, see, he knew. He had the information. And so
sure he did.
He didn't. He had every good reason to be hoping
mm-hmm.
for that. But then, and to be disappointed, like he's sort of, expressing here, mm-hmm. that the U.S. did come in and what a problem it is. But, he doesn't say it's a problem, but he still says that England would be better off if they would just shunt Roosevelt off and join Europe.
And certainly history has proved him exactly correct.
Yeah, exactly, right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All right.
Okay. Now he, this 24th of January, 1942 in the evening, he really hammers bureaucracy. And when I read this, Carolyn, I couldn't help but think about our bureaucracy over here and how inept, inefficient and everything that it is, because and it was something to read that they had the same problem over there.
Yeah, probably not as bad.
Yes, not near as bad, but in his own government, and you'll be able to tell by his criticism what I'm talking about. Goering wanted to
now he had a Himmler was a special guest.
Oh yeah, that's right.
And he's
special
there a lot.
Is Himmler.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and by the way, it says here a dialogue with Van Papen. I checked a German speaker on the pronunciation of Papen, and
yeah.
It is Papen, which sounds funny to me. I kind of like the Papen, but it's like the ah sound in Maul, this person said, but I can think of it like Hans, Hans Lammers, Papen.
Yes, yes.
That's kind of an A. All right, so we get that right now.
All righty. Goering wanted to get from me a decree conferring powers on Stuckert and Reinhardt so that they could undertake the reorganization of our administrative services with a view to simplifying them. I refused. Why entrust these men with such a mission when it's precisely the Ministry of Finance and Interior, which are their field, whose administrations are plethorically swollen? There are two ways of revising the administration: a reduction of the budget or a reduction of personnel. The fiscal system is uselessly complicated. Since the days when people paid the crown its tenth, there's been no end to the process of adding supplementary taxes to this tenth. The simplest method consists in restricting oneself to the four following taxes: a tax on luxury goods, a stamp duty. Everybody obtains the stamps he needs. It does not require any costly administrative apparatus, and it's a tax that is not oppressive. Old Austria had this tax. No tradesman could sell anything at all without stamps. He bought them at the post office, which confined itself to keeping an account of the sums realized. Three, a tax on private means, and four, a tax on commercial profits. As regards direct taxes, the simplest is to take as a basis the amount paid the previous year. The taxpayer is told you will pay the same sum as last year. If this year your earnings are lower, you'll report that fact. If they're higher, you'll immediately pay a proportionate supplement. If you forget to announce the increase in your income, you'll be severely punished. If I explain this system to the Ministry of Finance or to Reinhardt, the reply will be, after an instant's reflection, "My Führer, you're right." But within 6 months, they'll certainly have forgotten everything. Thanks to this method, one might reduce the bureaucracy to a third of its present importance. The snag is that a tax which is easy to collect doesn't suit these gentlemen of the administration. What would be the use of having been to a university? Where would one find jobs for the jurists? There'd be no more work for them, for everything could be done by means of an extremely simple piece of apparatus, and the Chinese puzzle of declaring one's taxes would be done away with.
I thought that was great because, you know, that's what we're always talking about here in the U.S., the complexity of the tax
yes.
code. They're trying to simplify it, but he's saying there, it's the same thing, Chinese puzzle. Where people have to, trying to figure out your taxes, you have to pay somebody to do it.
Yeah.
Well, I don't, but a lot of people do. Most people do.
Right. Lammers told me, "My Führer, I've been using the simplified method since the beginning, and it works. All the other systems are too cumbrous." If I now give a jurist the job of simplifying the mechanism of the administration, his first care will be to create an office of which he will be at the head, with the idea that, finally, it will entitle him to a minister's portfolio. I've had the same experience in the party. One decides to create a group of the Hitler Youth at Salzburg. Suddenly, they need a building of 500 rooms. Now, I've run a party of 800,000 members, and I housed all my administration in a few attics. Schwarz listens impassively to the demand formulated, and then he cuts in, "We'll start with 12 rooms."
Yeah, I wonder who this Schwarz is.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Something to do with the Hitler Youth, I would imagine. I'm all in favor of installing ministries in monumental and majestic buildings, but on condition that everything is reckoned out in advance in such a way that no enlargement can prove to be possible, not even in height. In this way, a ministry learns to make use of its organs of execution. It confines itself to controlling. It avoids direct administration. The Republic of Venice, which used to reign over the Adriatic Sea, was installed in the place of the Doges.
I think that's the Doges.
Doges, the capital D-O-G-E-S,
mm-hmm.
which today still houses the entire administration of the city. I created the Ministry of Propaganda with the idea that it should be at everybody's service. Thus, I myself can do without a propaganda service. It's enough for me to have the possibility of taking my telephone off the hook and asking the question, "Hey, Herr Doctor, how am I to set about such and such a matter?" Yet there practically doesn't exist a ministry today that hasn't its own press service. They ought to find the services of the Ministry of Propaganda enough, since it's I who give the Reich's propaganda ministry its directives. Why should I maintain a private press section? In the days when there was a vice chancellery, that service had a budget of 600,000 marks. One day I asked Lammers, "What is that shop?" He replied, "It's a swindle." Lammers had held an inquiry and had discovered that all the people I'd sacked from the chancellery had found jobs again in the vice chancellery. When Poppin proposed the vice chancellery to me, I explained to him, "A vice chancellor never becomes active except when the chancellor is ill. If I am the vice chancellor, you will never be ill, so I refuse the vice chancellery." Personally, Poppin was an inoffensive man, but by a sort of fatality, he surrounded himself with people who all had something on their conscience. Jodl interposed, "In the Wehrmacht, the bureaucracy has become frightful. The Minister for War has made it a point of honor to imitate the other ministers, as concerns both style and practice. The individual personality has disappeared behind the administrative entities, and I consider that unworthy of a soldier. Nobody speaks any longer in the first person. Everybody expresses himself in the name of an entity. It's the triumph of impersonality.
So, you know, is he saying that when people in the Wehrmacht are talking to one another, or the Minister for Ministry of War or something? I didn't even know they had a Minister of War. Mm-hmm. But that instead of saying saying their name or whatever, or I,
yes.
They're saying the Field Marshal. They're calling themselves in the third person.
Well, what I thought he meant was they're saying the party will have it this way, or the Reich will have it this way. Not their own names attached to any kind of order or anything like that. And speaking in
Their office kind of.
Yes.
Yeah.
This is what's decreed, and it's not by some individual. You know, they don't mention the name of themselves or whatever. They'll just say the party has decreed this, and that's why Yodel says, you know, nobody speaks any longer in the first person, and it's because they were shirking responsibility an awful lot of the times, and they were afraid.
Mm-hmm. People wanted to take responsibility.
Yeah, they could hide behind, well, we're doing it for the state, so who are you to condemn or question it? That's the way I took it.
I can't think of the right word for it. Whatever group they were in, whatever military unit they were in or something, they would say it in the name of that, maybe.
Yeah, in essence, it was a military bureaucracy. And,
yeah.
And so, you know, I imagine that involved the supply, the arsenals and things like this, and people in charge here and there, not people at the front.
Yeah, and that's Alfred Yodel.
Yes.
He was always there, too, and probably almost always taking meals.
Mm-hmm.
At the general meal time.
And so he quotes Yodel, and then he says, Himmler interposed in turn, I've arranged that each of my subordinates shall sign everything that issues from our offices with his own name and in a legible fashion. Thus one always knows with whom one is dealing, and nobody can take refuge behind abstractions. What is scandalous is the tone of our administrative people in their relations with the public. Every summons to a meeting, every tax demand is, in its general effect, an offense against the citizen. I've had all our forms of summons canceled and ordered them to be replaced. Now the first summons is in the following set terms. I request you, on behalf of the President of Police, to be so kind. If you are unable to attend, I should be grateful if you would inform me in writing concerning the matter mentioned above. If the recipient makes no move, he receives a second letter as follows. You did not answer my summons. I draw your attention to the fact that you are obliged to... The Führer replied, that's why I've never been able to make up my mind to praise publicly the body of officials generally. All that should be reviewed from top to bottom. The best thing you've done, Himmler, is to have transformed the incendiary into a fireman. Thus, the fireman lives under the threat of being hanged if there's an outbreak of fire.
You know what I think this refers to? I remember in a speech by Himmler, one of his speeches, I'm not going to say which one I think it is because I'm not sure, but he's talking about how he put all the fire fascination freaks or all the people who were suspected or arrested or had been caught or whatever, setting fires.
Yeah.
He put them in the fire department so that they would be, because he thought they were the best, he said they're the best people who knows how to catch other arsonists and understands the mind of the arsonist and so on. So he put them in charge of preventing fires because their fascination for fire was there, you know, and you couldn't get rid of it. And that's an example of taking German people who have some failings or problems, you know, and instead of just rejecting them and putting them in prison or something, finding a way that, that this can be usefully, you know, they can be used if, for a better purpose. And now I remember this, and then now I kind of think that maybe Hitler was saying that, but maybe it was Himmler. Anyway, I think that's what's being maybe Hitler got the idea from Himmler and talked about it.
See, Hitler spoke those words, but he's referring to, he said, this is the best thing you've done, Himmler.
Right.
You know.
Right.
Yeah, that's an excellent point.
Uh-huh. It's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And then the Führer goes on, I've sometimes wondered whether the tax the peasant pays in money couldn't be replaced by a tax paid in produce. In Russia, it will be absolutely necessary to do things like that. There will be barracks there where one will be able to collect tithes. It's easier for the peasant to pay in produce than to trot out the ready money. Life used to be very hard for the peasants. To them, a good crop used to mean more work and not more money. A bad crop was simply a disaster. It was the middleman who pocketed the profits. Now, I like that paragraph right before the last one, Carolyn, where he says, I've sometimes wondered where the tax the peasant pays in money couldn't be replaced by a tax paid in produce. And what he's talking here, of course, is the basis of autarky, which is bartering. Germany had no gold and whatever, and when they would swap, they would trade things that they had for the goods that they needed, and the money boys were left out of the question, and that ticked off you know who. But the basis of things like that is bartering, and even the peasants, rather than having to go find money somewhere to come up with that, hey, and I'll bring some produce to pay what you owe and like this.
But,
so,
you know, this whole taxes thing,
mm-hmm.
You know, Hitler mentioned four taxes, and I don't know exactly what they were, like that one tax is kind of general and I'm vague.
Right.
But, you know, it seemed like a lot to me, but I know that Europeans are taxed to death. And they've always have been, I think, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's just one of those things. I mean, when they had these kingly rulers over them and so on, they just taxed them like crazy. I mean, they just took a lot of money out of the peasants. That's why they remained peasants, because they had so much to pay to the higher-ups there. Government is taken for granted in Europe much more than, say, the American tradition, where people still think they shouldn't have at all. It's too invasive. But, they've always got a lot of taxes, and I think maybe too much.
Well, sure, but you're exactly right when you said that system sustains the order. It sustains the level. It keeps the elite in position, and it keeps the little guys from ever attaining anything but what they are.
Yeah.
It just sustains the present situation.
So Hitler wasn't getting he wanted to improve the taxes the way, you know, he had some good ideas about it, but mostly he was going to just use the meritocracy to find talent amongst all the people, but not to really lower taxes or have a more of a libertarian type society, because National Socialism was very, you know, national government dominated, you might say, whatever.
Yeah, simplification, you know, was the name of the game.
Yeah.
That he was trying to install.
Okay,
we move on to the night of the 24th and 25th of January, 1942. Whatever one says, Tristan is Wagner's masterpiece, and we owe Tristan to the love of Mathilde Wissendonck inspired in him. She was a gentle, loving woman, but far from having the qualities of Cosima. Nobody like Wagner has had the luck to be entirely understood by a woman. Those are the things that life does not owe a man, but it's magnificent when it happens. Neither Mozart nor Beethoven, neither Schiller nor Goethe have had a share of such happiness.
Now, speaking of her name, you know, I didn't check it out, and I could be wrong, but I just don't like the sound of Cosima, and I'm thinking it must be more like Cosima.
Cosima? Yeah, I thought of that too. Stress.
Yeah, well, let's try that, and then we'll have to check it out and find out for sure.
Yeah, we'll do it. Those are things that, well, let's see. Yeah, go to. In addition to all of Wagner's gifts, Cosima was femininity personified, and her charm had its effect on all who visited Wahnfried. After Wagner's death, the atmosphere at Wahnfried remained what it had been during his lifetime. Cosima was inconsolable and never ceased to wear mourning. She had wanted her own ashes to be scattered over her husband's tomb, but she was refused this satisfaction. Nevertheless, her ashes were collected in an urn, and this urn was placed on the tomb. Thus, death has not separated these two beings whom destiny had wished to live side by side.
Well, I'm saying here, Hitler is waxing romantic here.
Yes, I agree.
Typically German, you know, every German has that. And he goes on even more.
Oh, yeah.
This is a very interesting section.
Wagner's lifetime was also that of a man like Meyerbeer. Wagner is responsible for the fact that the art of opera is what it is today. The great singers who've left names behind became celebrated as interpreters of Wagner. Moreover, it's since him that there have been great orchestra leaders. Wagner was typically a prince. His house, Wahnfried, for example. It's been said that the interior, in Mecart style, was overloaded. But should a house be mistaken for a gallery of works of art? Isn't it above all a dwelling? The framework for a private life with its extensions and its radiance? If I possess a gallery of ancestors, should I discard it on the pretext that not all the pictures in it are masterpieces? The houses of that period, and the same remark is equally true of Mackart's studio, were filled with private memories. As far as I'm concerned, I keenly regret that Mackart's studio hasn't been kept as it was in the artist's lifetime. Respect for the venerable things that come to us from the past will one day benefit those who today are young. Nobody can imagine what Mackart's vogue was like. His contemporaries extolled him to the heights.
Well, you know, I wasn't familiar with him, and I looked him up, and his paintings are fantastic. And they have a certain element of fantasy, although they're realistic, but he was an incredible draftsman and painter of, you know, just really handle the medium with expertise and beautiful. They were very beautiful. So he was a 19th century Austrian academic history painter, according to Wikipedia, and a designer and a decorator. And he was most well known for his influence on Gustav Klimt. Gustav Klimt became very famous in the 20th century, and I think this Mackart was a whole lot better of a painter than Gustav Klimt, who I think is overrated for sure, and one of these a little too modern. But he was an influence on this Klimt and other Austrian artists. But in his own era, he was considered an important artist and a celebrity figure in the high culture of Vienna, and attended with almost cult-like adulation. Well, that's who Hitler is speaking about, and he obviously thinks highly of his work.
Sure.
Yep.
At the beginning of this century, there were people called Wagnerians. Other people had no special name. What joy each of Wagner's works has given me. And I remember my emotion the first time I entered Wahnfried. To say I was moved is an understatement. At my worst moments, they've never ceased to sustain me. Even Siegfried Wagner. Houston Stuart Chamberlain wrote to me so nicely when I was in prison. I was on Christian name terms with them. I love them all, and I also love Wahnfried. So I felt it to be a special happiness to have been able to keep Bayreuth going at the moment of its discomfiture. The war gave me the opportunity to fulfill a desire dear to Wagner's heart, that men chosen amongst the people, workers and soldiers, should be able to attend his festival free of charge.
It's Bayreuth.
Bayreuth?
Okay. Yeah.
The 10 days of the Bayreuth season were always one of the blessed seasons of my existence. and I already rejoice at the idea that one day I shall be able to resume the pilgrimage.
That was quite a, you know, I mean, I just say wow here, because that is quite a speech he gave there, showing a lot of feeling and emotion, or a lot of love for something. And we know how he felt about Wagner. He talks about it in a lot of different ways, but, you know, he repeats it here, and just how special it all was to him, and how happy he was when he was with that family who appeared to love him. And, of course, Cosima did love him very much, and she never, ever turned against him after the war or anything. And some of the children did, kind of, but no, they didn't all. Anyway, that was a very special thing for him. And then, of course, he's going to go on some more into this to explain why, and that's going to be interesting.
Oh, yeah. I wanted to make mention of one thing that was mentioned there. I just read, I was so pleased to see the name Houston Stuart Chamberlain written, you know, when he said he wrote to me so nicely when I was in prison. That was one guy, a historian, that if more people would have been honest about where he was coming from, and today he's really ripped. Even when I was went back to school to try to get my degrees, one of the history profs that I had mentioned Chamberlain, you know, with disdain as a Germanophile and pro-Nazi, all that stuff, and had nothing good to say about him when the guy was a genius and a good person. And he actually married Richard Wagner's daughter. And
that's where that comes in, huh? I didn't realize.
Yes, yes, it was after Wagner had died, but he was Wagner's son-in-law.
So he was in the Wagner family then.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. In fact, he was Brit. He was born Briton.
Yes.
But
yeah.
I think it was about 1907, he became a citizen of Germany, and he lived from 1855 to 1927, I believe, Carolina. He was 71 when he passed, but he had a fantastic book called The Foundations of the 19th Century, where he laid it all out in a racial perspective about history and how important race was. And he defended himself quite nicely by those that even attacked him then as anti-Semitic. But it was a very important person, as far as I'm concerned. Okay, the tradition of the Olympic Games endured for nearly 1,000 years. That results, it seems to me, from a mystery similar to that which lies at the origins of Bayreuth. The human being feels the need to relax, to get out of himself, to take communion in an idea that transcends him. The Party Congress answers the same need, and that's why for hundreds of years men will come from the whole world over to steep themselves anew once a year in the marvelous atmosphere of Nuremberg. They'll come, and they'll see side by side the proofs we shall have left of our greatness, and at the same time the memories of old Nuremberg. On the day following the end of the Bayreuth Festival, and on the Tuesday that marks the end of the Nuremberg Congress, I'm gripped by a great sadness, as when one strips the Christmas tree of his ornaments. The Congress, for me, is a terrible effort, the worst moment of the year. We shall prolong its duration to 10 days so that I may not be obliged to speak continually. It's because of the superhuman effort which demands of me that I was already obliged to have the opening proclamation read out. I no longer have the strength to speak as long as I used to. So I'll withdraw when I realize I'm no longer capable of giving these festivities the style that suits them. The most difficult effort comes at the march past, when one has to remain motionless for hours. On several occasions, it's happened to me to be seized by dizziness. Can anyone imagine what a torture it is to remain so long standing up, motionless, with the knees pressed together? And on top of that, to salute with outstretched arm? Last time I was compelled to cheat a little. I also have to make the effort of looking each man in the eyes, for the men marching past are all trying to catch my glance. In future, I must be given cover against the sun.
I love that part.
Yes.
Because, you know, it shows that this wasn't all fun and games. It's true. Mm-hmm. He did. I didn't think about how he stood there that whole time. Yes. That was thousands of people marching by. And he's right that they're all looking in his direction, and they're hoping that they can catch his eyes to, you know.
Sure.
And I remember Willie Crispin, you know, saying that he said Hitler looked right at him, and that made such a huge impression to him.
Sure.
And they all want that. And so he's trying to satisfy that. And for all that time and holding his arm out, I could never, ever do it.
Oh.
Not in a million years.
Yeah, you know, and I was happy with that section too, because it took away the impression that the man was a robot, mechanical, you know. He was very much the human being, and with the same weaknesses that, I mean, he would succumb to physical tiredness like we all did, and yet his stamina was unbelievable.
Yeah, it must have been. It was in those years, in the early days and so on.
Mm-hmm. The Pope is generally a frail old gentleman. He's therefore carried under a baldaquin?
I don't know. I didn't look it up.
Yeah, I think that's it, a baldaquin. Yeah, it's they used to wave palms around the pharaohs to give them some air. After the war, it will perhaps be best to have the columns march past 16 deep and not 12 deep as hitherto. The march past would last 4 hours instead of five, and that would always be so much gained. And so you're right. You know, you were talking about the troops marching by, and they were 12 deep from him, and it's like if they increase that to 16, it's going to cut the time down for them to pass by a full hour.
Yeah, and I think he's standing there for 5 hours or even 4 hours.
Yeah, even four.
So,
yeah.
I don't know. I would think he would have to drop his arm once in a while.
Yep.
But he always had to use the same arm.
Mm-hmm.
He couldn't switch arms, I don't think.
No, that's right.
So that is torture. I don't know how he could do it.
Sure.
Anyway, interesting.
Mm-hmm. The night of the 24th and 25th of January, 1942. My life is in the hands of a few individuals. My driver, my orderlies, perhaps also a cook. Kimka begged me in the spring to allow him to rejoin an armored unit. I wonder which is the more useful to the nation, the man who shoots down some enemy tanks, which others could do in his place, or the man who continues to be the driver who enjoys all of my confidence. He's been in my service for 9 years now, and I've nothing but praise for him. His predecessor, Schreck, was a companion of the years of struggle. When things went badly around us, the frontline soldier awoke in him. In such situations, Kimka would perhaps have fainted, but he drives with extraordinary prudence, always excepting when he's suffering from unrequited love, and that I notice at once. After all, I can't devote my time at the present juncture to training a new driver. If I were certain that Kimka would return safe and sound, I'd perhaps give in. How many of my drivers I've had who've lost their heads simply because I was sitting beside them. Kimka is calm personified. Besides, I'm accustomed to chatting with him. Eichenberg drives well, but I'd have to train him. He drives well mechanically, but he hasn't the initiative. I've done more than 2.5 million kilometers by car without the slightest accident. When I rode with drivers for whose training I was not responsible, it was a matter of luck that nothing happened. I've always insisted with my drivers, Maurice, Schreck, and Kimka, that the speed at which they drive should allow them to pull up in time in any circumstances. If one of my drivers killed a child and excused himself by saying that he'd sounded his horn, I'd tell him, a child has no judgment. It's for you to think. I find it unpleasant when a car splashes mud on people lined up on the edge of the road, especially when they're people in their Sunday clothes. If my car passes a cyclist, I don't allow my drivers to keep up the same speed except when the wind immediately scatters the dust we raise. When the rear tires shriek, that's a sign that the driver has taken a bend badly. It's a rule that one should accelerate only in the bend and never before. The more our drivers succeed on the whole in driving well, although not always exactly in the manner that suits me, the more our ruling class drives miserably. Of course, I've not invented the theory of driving, but I can learn from other people's experience. Adolf Mueller once took me in his car, and thanks to him, I learned more in a few hours than during the years that had gone before. In former times, I used to read regularly the publications devoted to the motor car, but I no longer have the time. Nevertheless, I continue to be interested in all new advances made in that field. I talk about them with Kempka. He's a man who knows all the motor cars in the world. It's a pleasure to see, since it's his job to bother about that, how well our motor car park is kept. Junge, too, asked me for leave to return to the front. If I had the feeling that he didn't want to spend his life with me, I'd give him permission to leave me in his own interest. It would be better for his future. Young is by far the most gifted of my orderlies. I hadn't realized that until I went to Felsennest. There, during our air raid alerts, I often had the opportunity to talk with him. You've no notion what a cultivated boy he is. Lings, L-I-N-G-E.
Yeah, Linga.
Linga is a good chap, but less intelligent and very absent-minded into the bargain. As for Busman, he's of a distinctly inferior class. Krause, or some call it Krause, but Krause had a morbid tendency to tell idle stories. That was no part of his duties. He used to tell lies absolutely without motive. I'm a very tolerant employer, and I readily admit that one can occasionally be inattentive. In such a case, I confine myself to drawing the silly fellow's attention to his fault, and I ask him to be less absent-minded next time. But I cannot endure lying.
Oh, that's great. I like this part almost best of all. Mm-hmm. Because I've read some of the books by these people, and I know like this Junge, Hans Junge was a tall, good-looking orderly of Hitler's, and he Hitler kind of had a role in getting him to marry his secretary. What was her for? Traudel. And she's known as Traudel Junge because they got married after she was there for a while in the headquarters, because she became one of Hitler's private secretaries that was always there where he was. And there's pictures of them and so on. I can't think of what her name was before it was Junge, but it was kind of a long, funny name, not as nice as this. And then this Kempka, though, he was a young, good-looking chap, really handsome young man, and Hitler speaks so well of him. And looking at pictures of him, he just looked like he was in the SS. They all were in the SS, and he was just looked like he was, proud, and also he wanted to behave himself just right, because he was Führer just so, right. And Hitler paid a lot of attention and talked a lot with these people. Sometimes he sat right next to Kempka, in the front seat when they were traveling. And, and Hitler got used to these aides of his, and he didn't like to change them if he didn't have to. Well, I don't know. I had some pictures of this Kempka. I liked him a lot. He looked like such a fine young fellow. And I guess he couldn't find a woman, though, kept losing them.
Yeah.
But
Hitler did say, about Kempka, he said he drives with extraordinary prudence, always except when he's suffering from an unrequited love.
Right.
So, he had his girlfriend, and he was thinking about her. But, I agree totally with you on the entertaining value of this particular section, because, once again, it's so human, it's so down to earth, And the very first sentence that starts this, when he says, "My life is in the hands of a few individuals, my driver, my orderlies, perhaps also a cook." Those are things you don't ordinarily take into account. And when he says he was went over 250,000 kilometers by car and never an accident, you know, things like that don't just happen. He has trained people taking care of him.
Yeah, and then he puts his own attention on it quite a bit. Mm-hmm. He's saying how he's training them. He tells them they have to do it this way, that way. He pays attention to the details in every instance.
And he talks to these guys, you know, like they're like their family, you know. So
well, he considered them, you know, all those people in his inner circle there that were always at headquarters, his SS adjutants and his secretaries and so on. He took a real interest in them. He knew everything about them, just about, and you know, and treated them very nicely and very well. And this Linga, I thought I was kind of surprised to hear him say Linga was less intelligent. Linga wrote a book too, and he was. He was very, very good, you know, spoke very well of Hitler all the time. And he seemed to do a good job because he took the place of somebody who had made some bad errors in, he was like a valet. But they're all interesting people, and they wrote nice, they wrote interesting books. And now here's Hitler talking about them.
Well, so, you know, what, Carolyn, what I think about that, I don't know when Linga wrote that book, but, you know,
it was a lot later.
Yes, yes. And see, when he worked for Hitler as a driver or as an orderly, he was a young fella, you know. And when he wrote that book, he had much more life experience and things. And so, and he would definitely come across as, like you said, seems very intelligent and capable and whatever. And no doubt he was.
Well, he was. And, you know, here the thing is, he's extolling Junge's intelligence. He's saying he was really an outstanding fellow. If you talk to him, he knew a lot and so on. So he's just saying that Linga, in comparison, is not as intelligent as Junge was. But we shouldn't take it as saying that he was saying he wasn't intelligent.
Oh, yeah,
if he wasn't intelligent, he wouldn't have had him on his staff.
That's right, and it might simply have been a matter of maturity level, too.
Yeah.
Okay, the next section, the night of the 25th, 26th of January, 1942.
Oh, and I have another timeline for the 25th. Thailand declares war on the United States and the United Kingdom. See, now, I never knew they did that.
Mm-mm.
Or I hadn't paid any attention. As I say, I don't know much about the war in the Pacific. Why did Thailand do that? They became an ally of Japan or something?
Thailand, Burma, that whole area, the Japanese were building railroads and things like that through there to facilitate their waging of the war against the British. And those governments were... I mean, the Japanese could overrun and take them anytime they wanted to, and I think just to they had no resistance, no armies to speak of that could offer any resistance to the Japanese, and I think it was merely a fact of go along with the conqueror, with the muscle.
Right, right. So they were declaring war on the side of Japan, so to speak, because Japan was at war with the U.S. and the U.K.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, right. And then another one was the Japanese troops invade the Solomon Islands. So the Japanese were still in control, but the United States had finally landed on Samoa a couple of days ago.
Yeah, if you take a look at a map of that Southeast Asia region and from down from Japan all the way through there, you will see that those advances are getting them ever closer to Australia and New Zealand.
Yeah,
and so there was a plan, of course, and there was a method to the madness, so to speak.
That's why the Australians fought so hard, huh?
True. Okay. Now, this section, it's pretty doggone good, too.
It is.
Okay. He says, "I'm lucky I'm not married. For me, marriage would have been a disaster. There's a point at which misunderstanding is bound to arise between a man and wife. It's when the husband cannot give his wife all the time she feels entitled to demand. As long as only other couples are involved, one hears women say, 'I don't understand Frau so-and-so. I wouldn't behave like that.' But when she herself is involved, Every woman is unreasonable to the same degree. One must understand this demandingness. A woman who loves her husband lives only for his sake. That's why, in her turn, she expects her spouse to live likewise for her sake. It's only after maternity that the woman discovers that other realities exist in life for her. The man, on the other hand, is a slave to his thoughts. The idea of his duties rules him. He necessarily has moments when he wants to throw the whole thing overboard, wife and children too. When I think of it, I realize that during the year 1932, if I'd been married, I'd scarcely have spent a few days in my own home. And even during those few days, I'd have not been my own master. The wife does not complain only of her husband's absence. She also resents his being preoccupied, having his mind somewhere else. In a woman, the grief of separation is associated with a certain delight. After the separation, the joy of meeting again. When a sailor returns home after a long voyage, he has something like a new marriage. After months of absence, he enjoys some weeks of complete liberty. That would never have been the case with me, and my wife would justly have been bored to death. I'd have had nothing of marriage but the sullen face of a neglected wife, or else I'd have skimped my duties. That's why it's better not to get married. The bad side of marriage is that it creates rights. In that case, it's far better to have a mistress. The burden is lightened, and everything is placed on the level of a gift. The Fuhrer noticed two guests who looked somewhat crestfallen, J.W. and this C.H.R., S.C.H.R. He turned towards S.C.H.R. and explained, what I've said applies only to men of a higher type, of course. Relieved, S.C.H.R. exclaimed,
the S.C.H.R. is just there.
Yeah.
But I don't know what the C.H.R. stands for.
That's just what I was thinking, my Fuhrer. And then he says, I don't believe that W.H. will ever get married. Is he talking about Hoffman there?
No, because that would be Henry Hoffman.
Oh, okay.
He was
okay.
Married because he had a daughter.
Yeah, I don't believe.
I was trying to think of W.H. too, but they don't, you know, give
clue. I couldn't figure out who it would be.
No.
Will ever get married. He has created an ideal image of a woman, taking her silhouette from one, her hair from the next, her intelligence from a third, from still another, her eyes. And it's with this image in his mind that he approaches every woman. But there's nothing like it in nature. One must declare oneself satisfied when one finds one perfect detail in a woman. A girl of 18 to 20 is as malleable as wax. It should be possible for a man, whoever the chosen woman may be, to stamp his own imprint on her. That's all the woman asks for, by the way. Dora is a sweet girl, but I don't think that Kimka and she will be happy. For a girl like her, it seems to me that Kimka is too exclusively interested in mechanics. She's too intelligent for him. What lovely women there are in the world. We're sitting in the Ratskeller at Bremen. A woman came in. One would truly have thought that Olympus had opened its gates. Radiant, dazzling. The diners unanimously put down their knives and forks, and all eyes were fixed on her. Another time, at Brunswick, a young girl rushed towards my car to offer me a bouquet. She was blonde, dashing, wonderful. Everyone around me was amazed, but not one of these idiots had the idea of asking the girl for her address so that I could send her a word of thanks. I've always reproached myself most bitterly. On yet another occasion, I was at a reception at the Bayerischer Hof. There were splendid women there, elegant and covered with jewels. A woman entered who was so beautiful that all the others were eclipsed. She wore no jewels. It was Frau Heimstengel. I saw her again just once, with Mary Stock at Erna Heimstengel's. The three women together, one more beautiful than the others. What a picture. In my youth in Vienna, I knew a lot of lovely women.
Now he's off dreaming about thinking about women. He's in a very romantic mood during a lot of these days here.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder what's going on. Anyway, this Hofstangel. Mm-hmm. That's his wife, Frau Hofstangel. He was a Harvard-educated German businessman who was an intimate of, this is how Wikipedia puts it, an intimate of Adolf Hitler. And Otto, actually, his father married an American woman, but she was a German-American. So he spent some time in the United States. And but then he came back to Germany, and he listened to Adolf Hitler give a speech, and he was just so totally taken up, and he joined the party and got all involved in it. And they called him Putzel, and he played the piano, and Hitler enjoyed listening to him playing the piano. But then Putzel fell out of favor, and he defected because. And later he went back to the United States and later worked for Franklin Roosevelt. But he also married a woman who was an American, but a German-American. So he was kind of mixed, you know, between Germany and the U.S. And what happened was he was in a dispute with Goebbels. It went to the point that Hofstangel fell out of favor. Goebbels was in favor. And so Hitler removed Hofstangel from his staff in 1933. There's a lot of talk about him being a spy and all this stuff with the spying, and even, you know, Hitler being a spy and all this crap, you know, that they come up with on some of these sites. But, and he's in the center of it all. But he seemed to be, it seemed to be just pretty much the way it was. He was never disloyal to the Nazis in his work for Roosevelt, as far as I know.
Yeah.
But this woman, his wife, I guess Hitler thought she was quite beautiful.
Mm-hmm. No doubt.
Well, you know, there's no question that he appreciated women, and he certainly appreciated the charm and beauty of women. Didn't want, there's no secret about this, too, what he didn't want was to, where was that where he said, did you read that, or is that coming up? He said, one thing I can't stand is a woman getting involved in politics.
No, I haven't crossed.
Yeah,
across
so he doesn't want to talk serious, you know, man type talk with women. He wants
right.
women to be feminine, mm-hmm. pleasant, fun, charming, and be very much like that, and not get into anything serious. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, I think this is very good. It helps me to understand some things and know how to respond to him, because he says that. And he believed, and a lot of these people do believe, that a woman's life is all totally wrapped up in her man, in her mm-hmm. husband, and remains that. It's all she needs. It's all she really wants. Well, mm-hmm. at some level, yes. But then he says the man is busy. He's preoccupied. He's gone. And so the woman feels neglected. Well, so what's she supposed to do? It doesn't make sense for a woman to have her life all wrapped up in a man, when the man doesn't want to have to respond to that, you know, and answer that. So therefore, a woman has to have some interests of her own. So they say, well, she has her children, and then that gives her a different life. Yeah, but the children grow up too, and you know, once children get a certain age, they don't take up all your thoughts and so on. So to me, the whole thing, even from their perspective, is that women need to have something beyond this that they can devote themselves to, not just charity and so on. Not all women want to spend all their time doing charity work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I go along with the man-woman thing they say, but I think that women have to have some outlets, creative mm-hmm. outlets.
Yes.
And there's some, he does talk about women a little bit more later on. But I think we're going to have to stop here because we came out real good again, Ray, because we've only got a few minutes left here.
Right, right. I wanted to comment on this last section when he's talking about women, and all of it was fascinating to me. It was very good, but one sentence, I mean, he led up to that one sentence that really jumped favorably at me when he was talking about being at that by Richard Hoff at that location. Mm-hmm. And he says there were splendid women there, elegant and covered with jewels. And then he talks about this lady walks in, and he says, she wore no jewels. And that jumped at me because it says he looked at much more than surface. It wasn't the jewels that made a woman beautiful, you know, and that's kind of, he noticed past that stuff, that there's a really a beautiful gal here, and yet she doesn't need the diamonds or the rubies or whatever to accent her beauty. She's beautiful without it.
And, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, and I really like that in a man that takes that kind of notice, and so that sentence meant a lot to me. And
when all the women are wearing jewelry and so on, and then a woman who is truly is a beautiful or beautiful to some people, mm-hmm. And comes in and doesn't have any jewelry on, then that makes a big impression because she stands out from all the rest just for that reason. Mm-hmm. And I've heard women do that at times for that very reason, to wear this, you know, low neck dress and to a ball or something, and all the women have jewels, and then they don't have any, and they're the belle of the ball, you know, and everybody's chasing after them. But I was looking for a picture of Frau Hans Dangl, and I found one from early on, and she didn't look particularly beautiful, but she could have made a beautiful impression, you know. She didn't just have a classically beautiful face, but mm-hmm. you know, she could have looked very nice at certain times. So there you go. But Hitler liked the ladies, but he wanted them to be ladies, nothing more than that.
Right. Well, I want to take this opportunity to remind all our listeners to be sure and be with us next week, because this very first section is fascinatingly wonderful. Hitler talks about his love for dogs, the origin of the human race, beauty in the ancient Greece, the significance of mythology, thoughts on prehistoric cosmic theories. It's philosophical, and I think it's wonderful. So don't miss it.
Yeah, and there's lots of good stuff next week, even beyond that. So.
Right on.
Thanks, Ray. Thanks, listeners. And we will see you then. This is signing off with Hitler's Table Talk. See you next week.
Bye, folks.